Okay, the larger and shorter catechisms, what man ought to believe concerning God. Question 49 in the larger catechism. Question 49, how did Christ humble himself in his death? Christ humbled himself in his death in that, having been betrayed by Judas, forsaken by his disciples, scorned and rejected by the world, condemned by Pilate, and tormented by his persecutors, having also conflicted with the terrors of death and the powers of darkness, felt and borne the weight of God's wrath, he laid down his life in offering for sin, enduring the painful, shameful, and cursed death of the cross. Last time, we talked about the humiliation with respect to Christ's life. And now we're going to talk about the humiliation with respect to his death. In his life, we saw that again and again, he was, in fact, subjected to various circumstances and events which were presented to him to enforce this idea of humiliation, to, in fact, provoke in him a suffering, to add a dimension to his life that really is his passion, what we would describe as his passion. There is a suffering quality through his entire life that he underwent ultimately by that voluntary condescension whereby he became a man and was made subject to all of these various things to which men are made subject. But in addition to those things to which men are made subject, he was made subject to additional insults and injuries above and beyond the norm. And all of this is comprehended in what we call his humiliation, and it was all undertaken on behalf of his people. We're going to look now at his death, particularly the circumstances surrounding his death and the events that transpire in connection with his death. So we're going to spend a lot of time talking about the fact that he died and how he died, and this catechism question is really designed to make you think about all of the circumstances of his death that make him suffer death in a way that is perhaps, in fact, more grievous, more aggravated than for any other man. So whatever circumstance, whatever connection, whatever could possibly relate to his death and dying, all of the surrounding events immediately preceding and carrying through into his death and dying, if we consider them as they are, we're going to find that it's very difficult to conceive of not only these various instances that we're going to go through, not only are they in many respects the most extreme circumstances or the most extreme conditions that could be introduced to his death, But as we're going through and going through this point by point, issue by issue, condition by condition, we really need to keep in mind that all of these things don't just happen individually, but they happen as a conglomerate. And so it's bad. Each one of these is probably as bad as you can imagine if you really meditate on what's involved. But when you take all of these things and surround, he's dying a death unlike any other. In a more abject, despondent, despised, hopeless condition than any other man who's ever lived. And he does so willingly. As I'm going to emphasize that as we go. So, question one, what are the ways in which Christ has humbled himself in the events surrounding his death? Well, we know, first way is this. Christ humbled himself in his death by submitting to the great sufferings in the garden when his soul was made to feel the weight of the alienation from God.
Matthew 26, verse 38. Then saith he unto them, my soul is exceeding sorrowful, even unto death. Tarry ye here and watch with me.
This is interesting, I think, because of this. As we approach his death, in the case of believers, whatever the circumstances of their deaths, there is usually, particularly in a condition like this, when someone is dying, really a martyr's death. The martyrs have generally been upheld by a sense of the presence and comfort of God in their dying. But he's being denied all of this. As abject as his life was, as we reach the conclusion of it now, he's about to enter into new depths, new lows, new sufferings, really. Psychological sufferings. His soul is, in fact, troubled by this because he's made to feel the weight. He has a sense of what's coming. You know, when we slaughter animals, very often we stun them or do something first. We take them off and kill them separately so that they don't really know what's coming. It's considered more humane. In the death of Christ, not only does he know what's coming, he's already tasting what's on the other side. And it's not just in the case of, say, an unbeliever who may taste a little bit of what's on the other side before he dies, that's hell seated for one. Christ is undergoing a taste of hell seated for all of his people. So this is beginning to weigh upon him even before his death. All of the staves of comfort are being knocked out of the way. And in the garden, as he's praying, he's yielding up every human passion and seeking to bring every human passion into total submission to what he's about to undergo. And every fiber of his being has to be crying out against the injustice of what he's about to undergo. He knows what's coming, and it's wholly unjust. More so than any man. Remember, he's sinless. He has no guilt. He's not being saddled with any kind of guilt. So this is an assault that should be unbearable. But he bears it willingly. Right, he desires his disciples to act in sympathy and regard to him in this, his hour of agony, and, in fact, in consideration for their own advantage. I want to look now at Matthew 26, verses 39 and 41.
Matthew 26, verses 39 and 41. Verse 39, and he went a little further and fell on his face and prayed, saying, O my Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as thou wilt. And verse 41, watch and pray that ye enter not into temptation. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak.
Okay, and yet they exhibit little care for themselves, and if possible, they actually exhibit less care for him, unto whom, if you think about who they are, what they are, their station in life, they actually have the highest obligations to him. So look at Matthew 26, 40 and 43.
Matthew 26, verses 40 and 43. Verse 40, and he cometh unto the disciples, and findeth them asleep, and saith unto Peter, what, could you not watch with me 1 hour? Verse 43, and he came and found them asleep again, for their eyes were heavy.
Okay, so here he is at the moment of really the transition from being a free man to being captured and all the events that are going to transpire leading up to his crucifixion. He himself is in the deepest soul agony. That is to say that he has a very profound sense of abandonment, which he will reiterate upon the cross. But it's already begun. The sense of abandonment has begun. And now, when you add to that these people who are with him, with whom he's eaten daily, he's taught them, he's prayed with them and for them, he has help them in so many ways. He has been the master. He's clearly and by them recognized as being their superior. And now at this very moment, all of a sudden, they all exhibit this collective disassociation. They just sort of cut themselves off, and it's as if nothing was there between them. It's so bad, as I said, they not only do they not care for him, we can see they don't even care for themselves. They've just entered this entire realm of apathy at the very point, at the very moment when they should be caring the most about themselves and about him. That's part of his humiliation in his death. But it doesn't stop with apathy. It doesn't stop with this severance of a personal concern and connection. A second way in which he's humbled is in his being betrayed by Judas, a pretended friend, so adding to his afflictions. I look at Psalm 41:9.
Psalm 41:9. Through my unfamiliar friend in whom I trusted him. friend in whom I trusted, which did eat of my bread, hath lifted up his heel against me.
Okay, so even my unfamiliar friend, with whom I've eaten my daily bread, he's lifted up his heel against me. He's betrayed me. Now why is that? Well, if it was, in fact, you know, an enemy, an open enemy, if it was, in fact, someone who really wasn't, and this, I think this is important to understand here. Outwardly speaking, although Christ knows who it is who's going to betray him, humanly speaking, there's no reason for this betrayal in either direction. Jesus has given no offense, and frankly, as we're going to see in a moment, Judas himself acknowledges this in the end. This is entirely without reason. It's based upon just a simple betrayal, a turn of someone who should have been his friend, had every reason to be his friend. There really isn't any rationale that can be given, not even the money, as we'll see in a moment, not even the money, which is a consideration, but that doesn't even explain what's going on. In fact, that sort of complicates it and makes it worse, if you will. So, the rationale for the betrayal is not very apparent, because Jesus has given no offense, and Judas, for some reason, does it anyway. He does it. I mean, Satan enters into his heart, and he does it. And this is quite possibly those original cases that we talk about when people say the devil made me do it. We know that the devil made him do it, in as much as the devil can make anyone do it, that he moved him to do it. But he was a familiar friend. He was someone intimate. He knew where he knew what he ate, he knew where he slept. I mean, that's all part of how he knew when and where to go to find him. He knew his schedule. He knew him. Now, although he's betrayed, we need to pause here for just a moment and understand that just because he was betrayed does not at any time mean that he at any time was an unwilling participant in this. So although we're talking about all these things that pertain to his humiliation, his sufferings, his being despised and all of that, the fact is he does all of this and he does it willingly. So the betrayal does not indicate that there was any unwillingness in him to suffer. In fact, we know he presses himself into this crucible of suffering for us most willingly. Luke 12, verse 50.
Luke 12, verse 50. But I have a baptism to be baptized with, and how am I straightened till it be accomplished?
I have a baptism to be baptized with. How am I straightened till it be accomplished? He's really saying, how much is this binding me? It's restricting me. I have to do this. I'm I have to do it because I have no other choice. It's more like I have to do it in the sense that you do something because inwardly you have this overwhelming sense, this feeling of being compelled. You want to. Thus then, when the opportunity for him to flee and make escape from his capture was presented, he most willingly surrendered himself. Look at John 18, verses 4 through 6.
John 18, 4 through 6. Jesus, therefore, knowing all things that shall come upon him, went forth and said unto them, Whom seek ye? They answered him, Jesus of Nazareth. Jesus saith unto them, I am he. And Judas also, which betrayed him, stood with them. As soon then as he had said unto them, I am he, they went backward and fell to the ground.
So he has an opportunity. Right? He says, I am he. Literally, it just says, I am. And they fall backward. Perfect opportunity if you want to escape. When James Renick, the last Covenanter martyr, was taken, they knocked on the door. He answered. They said, Are you James Renick? He basically said, Who's asking? They said, The king. And he slammed the door in the face and ran out the back door. He took advantage of the moment. He got caught along the way, but he actually fired his gun, and in the confusion, he took advantage of the moment. Here we have a case where he could take advantage of the moment. He's an innocent man who's about to be taken and executed. Right? Here's an opportunity to walk away from it all, potentially. And he doesn't avail himself of that. In fact, when Peter makes an overture to rescue him, he prohibits it. John 18, verses 10 and 11.
John 18, 10 and 11. Then Simon Peter, having his sword, drew it, and smote the high priest's servant and cut off his right ear. The servant's name was Malchus. Then said Jesus unto Peter, Put up thy sword into the sheath. The cup which my Father hath given me, shall I not drink it?
Okay, so he, again, he could have added to all of this that was going on, the confusion and all, and maybe, in fact, probably would have escaped, humanly speaking. But he doesn't do this. He doesn't make the first move. And when he doesn't make the first move, that is the result of something that is passive with respect to him. That is, they're the ones who sort of stumble. He hasn't been taken. It's not any kind of active resistance on his part that's caused this opening. But he doesn't avail himself of that. And then when that's followed by this other event where Peter takes it upon himself to sort of cut his way through the crowd, Jesus stops him immediately. Says no. So he's going willingly. He's doing it willingly. And everything that we see in the Bible confirms this picture. But we need to understand, although he's going willingly, if you will, where he's going, how he's going, and what's going on around him, and the end to which he's going, all of these are surrounded by the greatest multiplying of sufferings imaginable. This isn't just simply a case of everything that could go wrong, possibly go wrong, does go wrong. This is a case where it's been so ordered that all would go so wrong that his suffering would be magnified no matter what facet of his existence we consider. And we need to keep that in mind. Again, we're looking at one thing at a time, but this is not as if he's being assaulted just at this point or that point. He's being assaulted on every side. Even when we face the greatest troubles and trials in life, very seldom does God allow us to be assaulted on more than a couple of points, in a couple of ways at a time. He's being assaulted literally from every direction. In other words, there's no relief. You know, he can't just close his eyes and make it go away. You know, he couldn't even sleep. His disciples could sleep. He couldn't sleep. It was not just a matter of not being able to sleep, but being awake, he was struggling. He was suffering agony in his soul. And the people that should have cared the most are entirely apathetic. And one of the people who should have been his most trusted friend turns out to be the arch traitor. The price which was given the traitor, which was the most they would offer for this heinous betrayal, was 30 pieces of silver. Look at Matthew 26:15.
Matthew 26:15. And said unto them, what will ye give me? And I will deliver him unto you. And they covenanted with him for 30 pieces of silver.
And that 30 pieces of silver is represented in the Bible as an instance of the highest contempt that could be cast upon our Lord. If we look at Zechariah 11, verse 13.
Zechariah 11, verse 13. And the Lord said unto me, cast it unto the potter, a goodly price that I was prized at of them. I took 30 pieces of silver and cast them to the potter in the house of the Lord.
Okay, so the 30 pieces of silver, and pieces of silver, we're talking about 30 shekels of silver. That's not a lot of money at all. It's really a token amount. And we know that because this is actually the price of a servant or a slave who's gored by an ox so that he dies. Look at Exodus 21:32.
Exodus 21, verse 32. If the ox shall push a manservant or a maidservant, he shall give unto their master 30 shekels of silver, and the ox shall be stoned.
Yeah, so this is the price that is assigned to him. It's as if he's about to be, it's as if he's a slave about to be gored by an ox. That's the price that is given. So he's being estimated in this price as a servant, and as a servant is really as good as dead. Right? This is about what the body of your dead slave is worth. That's how he's being valued. So the idea that Judas was doing it for the money, that really doesn't fit. And it's very interesting that in Matthew's gospel, it says they covenanted with him for 30 pieces of silver. It's both the amount that's promised, but the idea that they covenanted with him is pointing to the fact that all of this is transpiring as a result of him going through all of the motions of fulfilling the covenant of works. Men have broken the covenant of works. They have engaged themselves in different ways under a broken covenant of works, and that's what they've done here. It's a false accusation that is going to be made. We already know that. We'll come back to that. We already know that. Right? His one of his closest friends is being turned by this dynamic. This is somebody who is closest to him, someone who is in fact most in tune with what it is that he's been doing, and should have been the most sympathetic, like the others. In his case, he's not simply apathetic, he's not simply distanced himself, but he's now become an open enemy. He's moved from being a pretended friend to an open enemy. Now, had the wound been offered by an open enemy, that would have been bad enough. But being offered by a pretended friend who knew that Jesus was an innocent man, right, that makes what happened most grievous and sinful. Matthew 27, verse 4,
saying, I've sinned in that I betrayed the innocent blood. And they said, what is that to us? See thou to that.
Okay, so when Judas is sort of second guessing after all of this has gone down, he's been arrested, he's been hailed before the tribunal, he's on trial. Judas now acknowledges that Jesus is innocent. And that he shouldn't have done this. Now, what does that tell us? That tells us another thing about the circumstance of his death. He's betrayed by a pretended friend, not because his pretended friend thought that he had done anything wrong at all. He says he's an innocent man. He's betrayed then not even for good intentions, but for a reason which, no matter how we look at it, can only be described as sinful. In other words, Christ is taken at this point as a result of the sin of man. And there's no way around that. There's not even an intentionality escape clause, if you will, here. Judas is very clear. I know he's an innocent man. I shouldn't have done this. All right. Moving on. A third way. Third way consisted in his being forsaken by his disciples. Look at
Matthew 26, verse 56. But all this was done that the scriptures of the prophets might be fulfilled. Then all the disciples forsook him and fled.
All the disciples forsook him and fled. And not just a few, not even most of them, but all of them. So here he is. He's been taken. And now he's being hailed before the magistrate. And there's not only these people who before were apathetic, before perhaps had sort of distanced themselves in some way from him personally, and now they actually flee. So any possibility of hope arising, any kind of hope arising from that quarter, that is entirely eradicated at this point. You know, there's not even one person that he can expect is going to come back and, you know, say, I feel your pain. It's not going to happen. They've all forsaken him now. Again, remember, this is all you can't just look at one thing. You have to remember this is all going on at one time. When you have a really bad day, and every time you answer the phone, it's bad news. Every time you try to fix something or do something, something else goes wrong.
It's kind of like Job. I guess Job was a picture of the type of Christ.
Job is a picture of Christ in this suffering to a degree. Yes. He's a type of this kind of suffering in this respect. Yeah, his friends all turn on him. You know, these are all fair weather friends, it seems. There's nothing there to make them hold the course. They're not going to. They're already off. Really, if we consider, and we're going to see in just a moment, they're really off probably trying to save their own skin. They certainly have moved far beyond this idea that they should do anything to help him, that they should make any attempts to intercede on his behalf in any way. They're out of there. In fact, there's some reason to believe that to the degree that any of them hang around, like Peter, as we're going to see in a moment, that he's really hanging around to make sure that he himself does not get implicated in this criminal proceeding. Right. His denials, if we think about them, and I'm going to come back to that in just a moment, if we think about them, to a certain degree, they bear that kind of imprint of someone who wants to be there in order to make it clear, I'm not part of that. So they're fleeing from him at a number of levels, in a number of ways. They're distancing themselves. Not necessarily physically, but they're distancing themselves a little bit physically, but mentally, emotionally, politically. Anything that could get them in trouble now with the civil authorities or the ecclesiastical authorities, that all seems to be on their radar, right? They're thinking they need to get out of that line of fire. And they're pursuing them. So the event then is ordered by providence in order to enhance the suffering of Christ. For it's very afflictive when none stand to comfort or strengthen in times of trial. This is something Paul complains of a bit in 2 Timothy 4:16.
2 Timothy 4, verse 16. At my first answer, no man stood with me, but all men forsook me. I pray God that it may not be laid to their charge.
Yeah, it's sinful, but it's also adding to the affliction. Right? It's more afflictive when people are not in any way responsive to the need of the time. When people, you know, in your hour of need, they abandon you. That's even more afflictive. You know, the affliction you're going through is bad. And there are a lot of people who do this, by the way, just in general. You know, when people are going through hard times, difficult things are happening in their families or whatever, it's actually quite common for a lot of people to just back off, move away, distance themselves. A lot of people are not very forward. They don't really want to get involved when they know somebody's going through a lot of trouble. But usually there are some people. May not be a lot, but there are usually some. In Jesus' case, there's no one. There's no one, and there's not even a second string of people he could call. Right? There's not even a second group. Everybody, they're all gone. And that adds to this afflictive moment. This is part of that psychical shaking of his humanity that is going on in this culmination of his passion that is his life. This humiliation. Now, it's probably a further design of Providence in permitting the disciples to forsake Christ so that they wouldn't suffer together with him. He willingly suffered alone. John 18, verse 8.
Jesus answered, I have told you that I am he. If therefore you seek me, let these go their way.
So Jesus actually, he doesn't even try to hold them. You know, he could say, hey, look, they were with me. He doesn't say that. He says, your problem is with me, not with them. Let them go. And unlike him, remember, when they all fell back or when Peter tried to make a way out, he just went forward with his purpose. Unlike him, these others all take advantage of this opening. And they run. They go. Now, the fact is this, if they had been apprehended, they might have been accused, condemned, and crucified with him, which might have led some to conclude that he didn't bear the price of redemption alone, which is contrary to Scripture. Isaiah 63, verse 3.
I have trodden the winepress alone, and of the people there was none with me, for I will tread them in mine anger and trample them in my fury, and their blood shall be sprinkled upon my garments, and I will stain all my raiment.
Okay, so the prophecy is that he's going to suffer alone. And so prophetically, this does allow the fulfilling of this prophecy. He's going to suffer alone. And he does do it, as I pointed out, and as Scripture says, he did it willingly. He goes through this willingly. Nonetheless, as Paul pointed out, this is an affliction. This is an added injury. These are people who, again, called him master. They were with him daily. They ate with him. They prayed with him. They slept with him. They're all sleeping in the same place together. They're eating together. They're worshiping together. They have all these common bonds. A very close-knit community of disciples and a master. And when he's taken, they all flee. That's afflictive. All right, a fourth way. Fourth way was in his being disowned and denied by Peter. And this is important because it gives occasion to some to think he's not only persecuted by his enemies, but he's unworthy of being acknowledged by his friends. Matthew 26:69-72.
Now Peter sat without in the palace, and a damsel came unto him, saying, Thou also wast with Jesus of Galilee. But he denied before them all, saying, I know not what thou sayest. And when he was gone out into the porch, another maid saw him, and said unto them that were there, This fellow was also with Jesus of Nazareth. And again he denied with an oath, I do not know the man.
So now we're moving from this position of general fleeing, people fleeing from him, to a position now where we have to consider Peter. Judas might have been a pretended friend. Peter is a real friend. And he actually disowns him and denies him. Now, this is another level of not just personal disappointment, but it's another level of affliction that's rolled into this providence. You know, at the end of it all, you might be able to say, oh, Judas, you know, he was a pretended friend. He wasn't an open enemy, he was a pretended friend. But Peter, for all that we know, and all that we find out about him later, he really was a true friend. And yet at this moment in time, Peter is shaken. Peter is, to the extent he's concerned, his concerns are basically about himself. You know, how do I get myself out of this? You know, there's been this terrible raid. The authorities have arrested the ringleader of a group. You know, I'm only here really to make sure probably that I'm not going to be indicted and brought in and put on trial and to suffer the same consequences as the leader of the group. He didn't do this even for that little bit of money. He did it out of fear, self-interest, probably a number of factors. But Peter is a friend. And he's now turned his back. And his denial is much more severe, in fact, due to his self-confident resolution before. Look at
Matthew 26:35. Peter said unto me, him, though I should die with thee, yet will I not deny thee. Likewise also said all the disciples.
So Peter says, look, if everybody else denies you, I'm going to die with you. And he is at the head of the disciples in this. And they all say, me too. Now, when things come down to that, the possibility of dying, Peter is maybe not so sure. Not really quite sure this is what... I'm not sure I signed up for this. You know, I thought I did, but now I'm having all kinds of second thoughts. Maybe there's something better I could be doing in my life right now. This is a degree from a human point of view, right? It's bad when a pretended friend betrays you. And it's worse when a real friend disowns you or denies you. But if that real friend has made this radical pledge that we're gonna continue together to the end. You know, everybody else might leave you. I'm not going to leave you. When people say things like that and then they turn on you, it's even greater in its affliction. There's a greater degree of affliction. Now, the fact is, again, Peter is here and they're in this the palace of the high priest, and his fear is certainly increased when he was faced with the accusation of one who was kin to the servant of the high priest sent to capture Jesus. Look at John 18:26.
John 18:26. One of the servants of the high priest, seeing his kinsman, whose ear Peter cut off, said, did not I see thee in the garden with him?
Did not I see thee in the garden with him? I mean, if Peter was not already concerned about how this might turn, all of a sudden being faced with the kinsman of the guy, Malchus, remember he cut Malchus' ear off and Jesus stopped him. Now Malchus' kinsman is standing there and saying, wait a minute, I remember this guy. Why wouldn't I remember this guy? He's the guy who had the sword that tried to cut off the ear of my kinsman. As whether they're cousins or we don't really know the full relation here. But they were both there with Peter in the garden, or in the garden where Jesus is captured. And this guy is positive And in fact, if the servants of the high priest who were active in capturing Jesus, if they were acting on lawful orders, then Peter's response, cutting Malchus' ear off, that was really resisting arrest. It was, this is criminal behavior. And puts him probably pretty close to the top of this whole circle of criminals from the point of view of the Roman government. So Peter's not in the palace in all likelihood to protect Jesus so much as letting his denials actually be heard. You know, he's basically trying to take away any rationale for them to come after him. You know, that's what he's doing. This is not just a simple denial. I don't know him. These are denials that are in the form of giving evidence, if you will. You're in a courtroom and you're in a sense you're being examined, and you're trying to put distance between yourself and the guy who's at the head of your racketeering conspiratorial group, right? He gets busted and they come after everybody. They're potentially looking, and you step out in order to make it very clear, not only I'm not with him, I'm not one of him, you might even be willing to give state's evidence against him, right? You're going to try to pull yourself out. That's how Peter's behaving here. So being disowned by Peter in this situation is, again, greatly afflictive. This is a guy, remember, not long before, he's ready to die with you, and he's the first guy pulling out a sword and ready to cut a path out of the garden. Now, all of a sudden, once Jesus submits to this capture, Peter starts to have all kinds of doubts as to where this is going. Everything in his mind starts to, reevaluate. The moment doubt enters in, everything that he was ordered in his thinking gets flipped. It's inverted, it's twisted, it's perverted. Whatever he was thinking, whatever he was aspiring to do or to be, all of that shifts now. Peter now is concerned to make sure at the end of the day he's looked out for number one, Peter. All of these denials are really sort of, you think of them as sworn depositions saying, I wasn't involved in the crime. That's kind of what he's saying again and again and again. He's not just saying, I don't know him, but these are people who are in the palace. They're assembling witnesses against him. Remember, they're trying to get all the witnesses against him. They can't find any. We find that out later. But they're assembling them. That's what all these people are. They're a bunch of false witnesses. Now, but that means that most of these people probably recognized Jesus, had something to do, they kind of knew. And if they're going to give evidence against him and then they tie you to it, you're in trouble. So Peter's upfront and quick to deny any connection. Anytime anybody is asserting there's some connection, I don't know the man. I don't know the man. I have nothing to do with that guy. I don't know. Wasn't me. I'm not one of them. That's the language you hear, depending on which gospel you're reading. He's talking like this to them, to avoid that very situation. And that's afflictive. All right, let's move on. A fifth way was as being scorned and rejected by the world as if an inferior to them. Look at Psalm 22, verses 6 and 7.
Psalm 22, 6 and 7. But I am a worm and no man, a reproach of men and despise of the people. All they that see me laugh me to scorn. They shout out the lip. They shake their head, saying,
Yeah, the people in the psalm, we have these words said in the mouth of the Christ that all men hold him in scorn. They shake their lip at him. They laugh him to scorn. So on that kind of language, what does this mean? Well, again, we have to consider, who is this who has come into the world? The eternal Son of God. The quality of the person that is under this continual assault, right? He's not simply marginalized, you know, treated as if maybe he's one of them, but of a lower class. But he's so far inferior that they actually feel free to treat him almost as if he's not a man at all. I mean, they only treat him as a man so much as it's necessary to treat him as the worst possible example, execration of a man that they can imagine, envision, and persecute. You know, they only hold him at that level of man because it offers more indignity than if he was a dog. You know, what they're doing to him actually is more indignant than if they were doing it to a base animal. So they don't just scorn and reject him, but they do it in the most pronounced way, right? He isn't simply treated to a cold indifference, but to a hostile despising. Look at Isaiah 53, verses 2 and 3.
Isaiah 53, 2 and 3. For he shall grow up before him as a tender plant, and as a root out of a dry ground. He hath no form nor comeliness, and when we shall see him, there is no beauty that we should desire him. He is despised and rejected of men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief, and we hid, as it were, our faces from him. He was despised, and we esteemed him not.
He was despised, we esteemed him not. Now, why is he being treated with this cold indifference, but not just that, it's something bordering more on a hostile despising, right? And bleeding over into that. Well, this kind of treatment, that he's this most abject inferior, barely a man, right? Worthy of the worst kind of scorn, despised and rejected of men. All of this is very doubtless designed to bring his doctrine into contempt. Look at Mark 8:38.
Mark 8, verse 38. Whosoever therefore shall be ashamed of me and of my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, of him also shall the Son of Man be ashamed when he cometh in the glory of his Father with the holy angels.
So we know that men are ashamed of him and his doctrine. And this attitude that is being displayed again and again is enforcing that. You know, the best way to beat any doctrine is ad hominem. You know, destroy the man, destroy the messenger, and you will, in the minds of many people, destroy the message. So this is designed to do just that. It's not, they can't attack him from the point of view of logic or morality or any kind of theological point of view. They can't get at him that way. There's nothing they can touch. He's above reproach in this way. Right? But by lowering him in the estimation of all men, by bringing him down as much as they can, to the point where he's almost no man at all, despised and rejected of men, they've cut off the temptation of many men to even so much as listen to him, to hear him, to give him any kind of hearing. And that brings all that he is known to teach, all that he is known to advance for the benefit of mankind. All of that's brought into disrepute because of this. Right? Though they did, he does invite them. The fact is, they reject his pleas because they rejected him. Look at John 5, verse 40.
John 5, verse 40. And you will not come to me that you might have life.
You will not come to me that you might have life. Why wouldn't they come? Something he did? Something he said? Probably for most of them the answer is no. Because most of them wouldn't come simply because he's despised and rejected of men. They wouldn't even give him a hearing. They would not give audience to anything that he advances. And so they shut it out. It doesn't matter how wholesome what he's saying is, how much they need to hear it, how much it would help them, how much it would redound to their spiritual benefit. None of that matters. They won't come to him that they might have life. It's instilled in them to despise him, to reject him. He's been discredited. Okay, so finally, a sixth way. Sixth way was his being condemned by Pilate. And Pilate does it with a sneer, unbecoming a judge in such matters. Look at John 19, verses 5 and 14.
John 19, verse 5. Then came Jesus forth wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe. Pilate saith unto him, Behold the man. And verse 14. And it was the preparation of the Passover and about the sixth hour. And he saith unto the Jews, Behold your king.
So Pilate, who, remember, Pilate himself seems to be pretty convinced he's innocent. And he condemns him anyway. He's condemned by him. And Pilate condemns him with a sneer in his mouth. He's condemns him, frankly, because he has no care whatsoever. There's no concern here. Everything he's doing is a political calculation. You know, he wants it to turn out okay for himself at the end of the day. He doesn't want the Romans to come in and say, hey, you didn't do a good job ruling over the Jews. We need a new governor. So he's willing to do for them whatever they want, to a degree. So he condemns them. And again, when you understand what's going on with Pilate and the condemnation, then you can almost hear the sneer. Behold the man. Behold your king. You know, he's doing this. He's mocking the Jews for what they're doing, but at the same time, he's also mocking Christ. There is something in this which is beyond what we would consider judicial temperament. Someone who's really a judge in a matter maintains a bit more of a distance from the personal aspects of what's going on, and is able to sort of remove himself from the passion of the moment and speak dispassionately so that justice is administered. Pilate does none of that. He really is not concerned at all about justice. He knows he's an innocent man. And he's going to try to saddle the guilt of the execution of this innocent man on the Jews. I just did what they wanted. This is all very afflictive and demeaning and humiliating. The very things that Christ is teaching, these things are all being brought up for ridicule. The And additionally, he was tormented by his persecutors, scourged, buffeted, smitten with their hands, and crowned with thorns. Turn to look at Matthew 27, verses 26 through 50.
Matthew 27, verse 26. Then released he Barabbas unto them, and when he had scourged Jesus, he delivered him to be crucified. Then the soldiers of the governor took Jesus into the common hall, and gathered unto him the whole band of soldiers. And they stripped him and put on him a scarlet robe. And when they had plaited a crown of thorns, they put it upon his head, and a reed in his right hand, and they bowed the knee before him, and mocked him, saying, Hail, King of the Jews! And they spit upon him, and took the reed, and smote him on the head. And after that they had mocked him, they took the robe off from him, and put his own raiment on him, and led him away to crucify him. And as they came out, they found a man of Cyrene, Simon by name, him they compelled to bear his cross. And when they were come into a place called Golgotha, that is to say, a place of a skull, they gave him vinegar to drink, mingled with gall. And when he had tasted thereof, he would not drink. And they crucified him and parted his garments, casting lots, that it might be fulfilled which was spoken by the prophet. They parted my garments among them, and upon my vesture did they cast lots. And sitting down, they watched him there. And they set up over his head his accusation written, This is Jesus, the King of the Jews. Then there were two thieves crucified with him, one on the right hand and another on the left. And they that passed by reviled him, wagging their heads, and saying, Thou that destroyest the temple and buildest it in 3 days, save thyself. If thou be the Son of God, come down from the cross. Likewise also the chief priests, mocking him with the scribes and elders, said, He saved others, himself he cannot save. If he be the King of Israel, let him now come down from the cross, and we will believe him. He trusted in God, let him deliver him now, and he will have him, for he said, I am the Son of God. The thieves also which were crucified with him cast the same in his teeth. Now from the sixth hour there was darkness over all the land unto the ninth hour. And about the ninth hour Jesus cried with a loud voice, saying, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, that is to say, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Some of them that stood there, when they heard that, said, This man calleth for Elias. And straightway one of them ran, and took a sponge, and filled it with vinegar, and put it on a reed, and gave him to drink. The rest said, Let be, let us see whether Elias will come to save him. Jesus, when he had cried again with a loud voice, yielded up the ghost.
So we have an entire series of torments that are being offered. It's not just enough to put him to death. At every point, every twist and every turn, something else is going on. They're spitting on him. They're hitting him. They put a crown of thorns on his head. All of this. Even their most merciful acts toward him inflicted more suffering. Look at
John 19:34. John 19:34. But one of the soldiers with a spear pierced his side, and forthwith came there out blood and water.
Yeah, so even in that, they viewed that as merciful. And the reason is because of what happens in crucifixion. They viewed it as relief, but their idea of relief was, you know, we're gonna put a big gaping wound in your side with a spear. Now, he was already dead, but the point is, this is happening to him as a result of this series of torments that are going on. And it's all happening as one torment is piled upon another, one more indignity is added to another, to the point where they end up desecrating his body. Okay, so he's even compelled here to bear his own cross until his very strength failed, divesting him of all humanity. John 19:17 and Luke 23:26.
John 19:17. And he, bearing his cross, went forth into a place called the place of a skull, which is called in the Hebrew Golgotha.
Luke 23, verse 26. And as they led him away, they laid hold upon one Simon, Cyrenian, coming out of the country, and on him they laid the cross, that he might bear it after Jesus.
So again, with the bearing of the cross, he's bearing it until his physical strength is broken down, till there's nothing left. He has nothing left. He can't do it. He just simply can't do it. Right? He's beyond able to bear this. So at every level, he's being treated with the worst kind of cruelty. He's being subjected to the worst kind of suffering and humiliation. He's going to bear this cross until he can't do it anymore. Literally, till he can't handle, he can't lift it. You know, if you've ever done really hard physical labor and gotten to the point where you just can't do it anymore, what he was put through was worse than that. If you've done a lot of heavy lifting and you stop, sometimes you feel like your whole body is trembling. You know, this is, you maybe are on the brink of exhaustion, but they pushed him beyond that. They pushed him to the brink of dissolution of body and soul before they have somebody carry this. He literally can't get it any further. He's driven until he can't move it anymore himself. That's reducing the dignity of his humanity to nil. Now, those are a number of the things in the events surrounding his death wherein he is humiliated. But there are some other things that we need to look at here in question two. What are the ways in which Christ has humbled himself in his death? It's first to be noted that in his death he was made to feel all of its terrors. Now look at Luke 22:44.
Luke 22:44. And he began in and being in an agony, he prayed more earnestly, and his sweat was as it were great drops of blood falling down to the ground.
Okay, so he's in great agony, praying. His sweat is like great drops of blood. He's, again, in great soul agony. Why? Because not only is there this outward abandonment going on, this sense of alienation, but there's this inward brewing of a sense of what's coming. Like when you're outside and it's a clear day and all of a sudden it gets dark and you can feel the temperature drop and the storm coming in, that's what's going on inside of him. He can feel the wrath of God closing in on him now. And as this sensation grips him, and as he moves closer to the moment of the agony of his death, he's sweating, as it were, great drops of blood. He's writhing in soul agony, including, as I say, the weight of the wrath of God at the very moment of his death. Look at Matthew 27:46.
Matthew 27, verse 46. And about the ninth hour, Jesus cried with a loud voice, saying, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani? That is to say, my God, why hast thou forsaken me?
At the very moment of his death, he announces this sense that he's been forsaken of God. this of total abandonment. In other words, all that is comfortable and familiar about God has been banished. And all of this foreboding and the terror and the agony of death because of sin is in its place. This isn't a place where there's any comfort. Though many martyrs have suffered much in this frail nature, 2 Corinthians 1:8.
2 Corinthians 1:8. For we would not, brethren, have you ignorant of our trouble which came to us in Asia, that we were pressed out of the heavens of all strength, insomuch that we despaired even of life.
But the fact is that he alone was stripped of all comfort and laden with all fearful dread in his death. Hebrews 5:7 and Lamentations 1:12.
Hebrews 5:7, who in the days of his flesh, when he had offered up prayers and supplications with strong crying and tears unto him that was able to save him from death, and was heard, and that he feared.
Lamentations 1:12. Is it nothing to you, all ye that pass by? Behold and see if there be any sorrow like unto my sorrow, which is done unto me, wherewith the Lord hath afflicted me in the day of his fierce anger.
Now, is there any sorrow like unto my sorrow? And the answer is no. You know, there's no sorrow like unto that in the day when he inflicts his fierce anger. You know, every judgment may be a taste of that, but ultimately Christ tastes of death for all those for whom he's died. There's no sorrow, there's no fearful judgment that is even remotely close to this judgment. Nothing close. His very soul is tormented as he drew near the time of his death, feeling the sting and bitterness of death in all its fury. Mark 14:33-36.
Mark 14:33-36. And he taketh with him Peter and James and John, and began to be sore amazed and to be very heavy, and saith unto them, my soul is exceeding sorrowful unto death. Tarry ye here and watch. He went forward a little and fell on the ground and prayed that, if it were possible, the hour might pass from him. And he said, Abba, Father, all things are possible unto thee. Take away this cup from me. Nevertheless, not what I will, but what thou wilt.
So he's being tormented. He's being made to feel the sting of death. He's being made to feel the bitterness of death. He's being made to feel the bitterness of death that is due to sinners. Now, that's not all. He's got the wrath of God poured out upon him, and yet we're told that's not all that he faces at this moment. Additionally, he was therein made subject to the powers of darkness, even him who has the power of death, the devil. Hebrews 2:14.
Hebrews 2:14. For as much then as the children are partakers of flesh and blood, he also himself likewise took part of the same, that through death he might destroy him that had the power of death, that is, the devil.
So at this time he suffered not only to fall into the hands of an angry God, but to fall into the hands of his enemies, that they might express their rage and malice against him. Look at Luke 22:53.
Luke 22:53. When I was daily with you in the temple, you stretched forth no hands against me, but this is your hour and the power of darkness.
Yeah, this is your hour and the power of darkness. In other words, this is the hour, this is the greatest time to be the devil. This is your moment. Shine, darkness. And he's subjected to that. And so the wrath of God and the powers of hell are unleashed upon him at once. And it overwhelms him. He submits to this willingly. Right. Second, he was made to fear the wrath of God because he was laying down his life as an offering for sin. Isaiah 53:10.
Isaiah 53:10. Yet it pleased the Lord to bruise him. He hath put him to grief. When thou shalt make his soul an offering for sin, he shall see his seed. He shall prolong his days, and the pleasure of the Lord shall prosper in his hand.
Okay, and as his wrath is so terrible in itself, we ought to be amazed and sorrowful that he underwent this, not for any sin of his own, but for our sin. 1 Peter 2:24.
1 Peter 2:24. Who his own self bare our sins in his own body on the tree, that we, being dead to sins, should live unto righteousness, by whose stripes ye were healed.
So what he bears in laying down this is everything, and the reason we're mentioning this after what he went through is, this is a reminder, he's going through this not on his own merit, if you will. Right? It's not because of something he's done. It's something that we've done. Something that mankind has done. It would be bad enough to be enduring the eternal wrath of God and the malice of the devil and the hour and power of darkness if you deserved it. But he doesn't. That's the point. He doesn't deserve it, and that makes it even worse. He bore everything which was a punishment for sin, excepting some circumstances peculiar to us, which were inconsistent with his perfect holiness, including that afflictive sense of the wrath of God due to sin. He bears that. Isaiah 53:6.
Isaiah 53:6. All we like sheep have gone astray. We have turned everyone to his own way, and the Lord hath laid on him the iniquity of us all.
The Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. Right, third, when we consider the kind of death that he was made to undergo, he was made to endure the most painful death of the cross. Philippians 2:8.
And being found in fashion as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient unto death, even the death of the cross.
Even the death of the cross. Even the death of the cross. That is, it's one of the most painful ways to kill anyone. If not the most painful way. Now why is it the most, well, it's the most painful because, first of all, consider the body itself was distended, being first stretched while lying on the ground, forcing it to attain its full length, so that being placed upright, his bones were drawn out of joint. Psalm 22:14.
Psalm 22:14. I am poured out like water, and all my bones are out of joint. My heart is like wax. It is melted in the midst of my bowels.
Okay, so here he is. They're nailing him to the cross, which is the cross beam, the Stavros. It's the cross beam. And he's made to lay down on the ground. And his arms are stretched out on both sides, as tight as they can, over this cross beam. And held in that place, so that when he is lifted up, the weight of his body is pulled down, and it rips his shoulders out of joint. Now remember, he's already been scourged. His back has been shredded. And that's important to understand what's going to happen here as well. Right, the nailing, number two, the nailing of the flesh so extended upon that cross, driving nails through the most sinewy and sensible portions of the body. Psalm 22:16 and John 20:25.
Psalm 22:16. For dogs have compassed me, the assembly of the wicked have enclosed me, they pierced my hands and my feet.
John 20:25. The other disciples therefore said unto him, we have seen the Lord. But he said unto them, except I shall see in his hands the print of the nails, and put my finger into the print of the nails, and thrust my hand into his side, I will not believe.
Okay, so they hold him in his taunt position, then they nail him to this crossbeam. And they nail him probably through the wrists, right, where they're able to get in that center of your wrist between the bones so that it holds you there. If you've ever suffered any kind of trauma to your hands or your wrists, it's some of the worst trauma you can ever experience. And this is being, these nails are being smashed through. The Hebrew says not they pierced, they digged out. It's like they were digging into that flesh and disturbing as much of it as they could to attach him to this crossbeam. And then you have to add third, the dreadful pain or the sudden jerk of his body when it's hoisted up on the tree. 2 Samuel 18:9 and John 12:32.
2 Samuel 18:9, and Absalom met the servants of David, and Absalom rode upon a mule, and the mule went under the thick boughs of a great tree, and his head caught hold of the oak, and he was taken up between the heaven and the earth, and the mule that was under him went away.
John 12:32, and I, if I be lifted up from the earth, will draw all men into me.
So he has to be lifted up in order to suffer this kind of death. And when they hoist up that crossbeam to nail it to the tree, as they hoist him, now everything is that can sag in him tries to sag. And so the nails and the flesh start to rip, and the bones and the sinews are pulled out of joint, and his body is hanging there. And the weight is such that it starts to collapse your lungs. And so in order to breathe, what you have to do is you have to raise yourself up. So they put a nail through your feet so you can push yourself up on that nail. And as you push yourself up, all of those wounds on your back are being ripped against that rough tree. And you have to lift yourself up to take a breath. That's why it was a mercy when they came around and finally broke your legs, because you would just suffocate. The agony would be over. But he was allowed to go through this. It was considered merciful for the Romans to pierce your side, because a lot of times the blood would start to build up inside your body, and that would make it even harder to breathe. So you could resist a little bit longer. You know, and it actually relieved you a little bit before you finally expired by letting out all of that fluid that was building up inside, which is what that soldier was doing. But in Jesus' case, we are told, fourth, it was a long and lingering death, hanging for 6 hours, from 9 in the morning until 3 in the afternoon during the heat of the day. So they're not just crucifying you. You get to do it in the bright sunlight of a Mideast summer day. Mark 15:25 and 34.
Mark 15 verse 25. It was the third hour, and they crucified him. And verse 34. And at the ninth hour, Jesus cried with a loud voice, saying, "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani," which is being interpreted, "My God, my God, why hast thou forsaken me?"
Now remember, at the top of this was left of the man, because they've so disfigured him, we're told, you know, between the scourging of his back, the pulling out of his beard, the beating that they've given to his face, administered to his face, the crown of thorns tops all of this off. Why does he have a crown of thorns on? Because all of creation was cursed because of man. And thorns and thistles are what the earth brings forth. And he dies fulfilling a broken covenant of works. What we broke, he fulfills. He takes himself upon himself the curse of the entire creation and crowns himself with that in his death. Now, this kind of death was considered the most shameful death imaginable. Hebrews 12:2.
Hebrews 12, verse 2. Looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is set down at the right hand of the throne of God.
Yeah, he's despising the shame because this kind of death was really reserved for the people who were considered the worst. The worst of the worst. When we talk about all of the different aspects of what they've done to him. Right? He's not just crucified, but he's crucified with every possible punitive aggravation that they could add, that they could think of to add to his crucifixion to make it more painful, more protracted, more grievous for him to bear. Whatever they could pile on, they pile on. This is the kind of death unto which malefactors of the worst sort were condemned. Deuteronomy 21:22-23.
Deuteronomy 21:22-23. And if a man have committed a sin worthy of death, and he be put to death, and thou hang him on a tree, his body shall not remain all night upon the tree, but thou shalt in any wise bury him that day. For he that is hanged is accursed of God, that thy land be not defiled, which the Lord thy God giveth thee for an inheritance.
And it's for this reason that men accounted it a most cursed death. Galatians 3:13.
Galatians 3:13. Christ hath redeemed us from the curse of the law, being made a curse for us, for it is written, cursed is every one that hangeth on a tree.
So these are the attendant circumstances, all of which are brought together in one major series of events that culminate in his crucifixion. And this is the humiliation of Christ in his death. This is the ultimate suffering that can be inflicted upon the human condition. He bore it in his death. Next time, we're going to look at his humiliation one more time, and that is in those events while he was dead and his burial and all of that. These are the last aspects of his humiliation before we take up the issue of his exaltation.